on Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. Also on the airwaves of Berkeley Liberation Radio. Archives of the show can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us for considerations at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you want to write us a letter, please address it to The Final Straw, care of WSFMLP 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This week we have three segments for the audience. You'll hear a segment written by Sean Swain, an anarchist prisoner in the Ohio prison system. You won't be hearing Sean's voice on this recording, despite Sean having his communication reinstated. Next, Williams spoke with folks involved in the struggle to save the Che Cafe, a social space present on the University of California San Diego's La Jolla campus. The Che Cafe is a 25-year running co-op space and venue that is now in danger of eviction by the university and is currently squatting their location. Check out the website for the Che Cafe at thechecafe.blogspot.com. Finally, Bursts and Williams spoke with an anarchist resident of Olympia, Washington, about the shooting of Bryson Chaplin and Andre Thompson, two unarmed young black men, by Officer Ryan Donald, a white Olympia PD officer, and some events that followed. We spent a good portion of the hour talking about police power, institutional white supremacy, anti-fascist organizing in response to the white nationalists who showed up at the rallies in Olympia, and some of the potential pitfalls of decentering struggle away from a critique of institutional power and towards the fringe reactionaries. Relatedly, there's been a call out for folks to engage in the July 25th, 2015 International Day of Solidarity with anti-fascist prisoners. From the call out, quote, "Anti-fascists fight those who, in the government or in the streets, dream of imposing their fascist and far-right nationalist nightmares on the rest of us. Throughout the world, Islamophobic, anti-Semitic, anti-immigrant, and racist bigotries are on the rise. Antifas are on the front line of confronting these reactionary politics, and we will not forget our comrades imprisoned in the course of the struggle," unquote. More can be found at nycantifa.wordpress.com. Also, to relate this to local issues in Asheville, North Carolina, a well-known character of the so-called National Youth Front, Daxter Reed, has been attempting to recruit at her local community college, AB Tech, as well as around the town and in the punk and metal scene. The goofball even tried to show up at the May Day rally, holding a sign for the NYF, and was summarily run off. It should be made apparent that these Nazis and their foolish antics are not welcome here. First, though, The Final Straw is soliciting folks in the audience with design skills to submit sticker and poster designs to us. We're hoping these stickers and posters can make their way out to book fairs, conventions, manifestations, and the walls and unsmashed windows of the world, widening our audience and spreading some audio anarchy further. We're looking for the designs to include the show name, our website at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and either imagery or words pointing to the nature of the show. If you have a design, you can send a mock-up or a completed version to thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net in PDF format. Designers of chosen images will receive some swag from Anarchy Land. Now here's Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Like a bomb. McDonald's workers and Alabama prisoners. I'm just off a complete communications blackout, so I've had access to very limited news brought to me mostly by Walt Disney News Corporation, designed to keep all of us hypnotized and under control. But I've heard bits and pieces about some events that involve McDonald's workers and Alabama prisoners. I don't know the details of those situations, but why should that stop me? I think what's transpiring with regard to McDonald's workers and Alabama prisoners is monumental and signals the beginning of something big. Here's why. In the 1990s, large corporations took advantage of international trade deals, moving jobs to locations that gave them greater advantages. They shipped U.S. jobs to Mexico, then Mexican jobs to India, then Indian jobs to China. It was a race to the bottom. In fact, today, manufacturing jobs aren't located in any one country, but are instead in a state of constant migration. There's now such a large pool of unemployed and desperate people in the U.S. that those jobs are circling back around on a second tour, returning at sweatshop wages. All of this was driven by a larger corporate strategy, of course, as corporations amassed more wealth that translated as more power, and the rest of us were left powerless and sleeping in our cars, if we were lucky to have a car. the corporations now hold everyone hostage, making outrageous demands for tax breaks and for subsidies, for workers to take pay cuts and give up benefits, or they'll pack up and leave for greener pastures. The problem those corporations now confront in the model of McDonald's workers and Alabama prisoners isn't a consequence of the corporation's failure to carry out their strategy. Their problem is more a consequence of its success. In the U.S., there's virtually nothing left but service industry jobs and prisoner slave labor. So look, sure, a handful of service industry jobs can be outsourced. A call center in India can book airline and hotel reservations. But sweatshop workers in Cambodia can't hand you a burger through the drive-through window in Milwaukee. It just can't happen. A majority of service industry jobs are geographically localized. The service industry worker delivers a product to a consumer where the consumer lives. So these same global corporations that outsource jobs all over the world are firmly chained in place where the product reaches the consumer. And that means companies like McDonald's and Walmart and others can't run for the border to avoid paying service industry workers. If McDonald's wants a worker to ask you if you want fries with that, they'd better dig deeper into their pocket and pay someone in your area to talk to you through the drive-through speaker. The call center employees can't get here. So, the same general scenario with a slightly different cast. States have balanced budgets and cut costs for decades by relying on prisoners to cook food and mop floors and keep the prison system operating. This slave exploitation has been taken for granted. While I'm not sure what's developed in Alabama, I can tell you that prison administrators everywhere face the potential of the same general dilemma as their corporate counterparts. If their prisoner populations freeze up and refuse to keep the prison system going, wardens can't fire their prisoners and replace them with peasants from China. Prison administrators are stuck with the prisoners they have, not the prisoners they wish they had. It appears McDonald's workers and Alabama prisoners are discovering the same truth. The wealthy exploiters in suits and ties with their briefcases don't really call the shots. Without McDonald's workers, the burgers don't reach the customers. Without prisoners, the Alabama state budget goes down the toilet. So, it seems that in this brave new world, there's new fertile ground for unionizing. The old dinosaur we call anarcho-syndicalism is back, a vision of the future brought to you by a blast from the past. So, along with continuing insurrections that will lead to future communes, as well as ongoing campaigns of sabotage, workers and prisoners are playing a vital role in grinding this capitalist death machine to a halt. There's no wrong way to resist. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from somewhere in the American torture complex. If you're striking, you are the resistance.
In this segment, Sean was talking about the Free Alabama and Mississippi movement's call for prison labor strikes against the kitchen factories where they put together McDonald's food products, as well as their comrades on the outside calling for a boycott of McDonald's products generally. For more on FAMM, check out freealabamamovement.wordpress.com and search McDonald's. To hear our interview from earlier this year with members of the Free Alabama and Mississippi movements, check out our archives at thefoundstrawradio.noblogs.org. Sean Swain has an impending transfer to a lower security facility in Ohio. You can find his new address when it's confirmed, as well as Sean's writings at seanswain.org.
Hey everyone, you're listening to The Final Straw on Asheville FM at WSFMLP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. I'm William Goodenough, and today we are talking with members of the collective of the Che Cafe, which is a student space, a radical student space on the campus of the University of California in San Diego. And we're talking to them because they are imminently facing eviction and are on day, I think, 95 or 96 of an occupation to help save the space. We talk about the history of the space and the current predicament that they are in. This interview is a transcript of an interview done with several members of the collective to preserve their anonymity. Thanks to Disembodied Voice for helping me read it out. Also, I'd like to give a shout out to the ex-worker for putting us in contact with members of the Che Cafe. The ex-worker is an anarchist podcast done under the auspices of Crime Think, and it comes out once about every month or so, I would say. First of all, will you talk about the history of the Che Cafe?
The Che Cafe actually started as the Coffee Hut in the late 1960s. The project to build the cafe cost $15,000 and was funded by student fees alone. It was the first student center at UCSD that was both student-funded and student-run. It hosted and continues to host discussions that facilitate brainstorming of marginalized or non-mainstream issues, race, social justice, climate change, non-hierarchical forms of student government, and so on. It had two main roles. First, it was the campus social center where student groups of all political persuasions and interests hung out and had discussions. And secondly, the collective is an incubator for cutting-edge, non-mainstream thought and gave birth to innovative ideas and practices. It's also important because it's a safe space where all students were and still are welcome to hang out. Especially at a time where oppressed peoples were facing violence. One example was where people in the LGBT community were facing violence. The Che held a series of LGBT-sponsored non-sexist dances in the 80s, providing a safe place where it didn't exist elsewhere.
Gotcha. I want to talk about safer space in a minute, but just to give some context, will you describe the space for listeners who have never been there? Is it more like a show space, or do people live there too? Is it still a cafe?
Do you want us to describe the space as it currently is, or also as it has been historically?
I was thinking more in terms of how it is today, just how it looks and feels to be there for the benefit of folks who haven't seen it. But also, if historical cues make sense, I'd be into hearing that for sure.
Before the occupation, it was more of a hardcore punk venue for music. But with the occupation, it has expanded to become much more.
What occupation do you mean?
Well, the UCSD administration is trying to evict and destroy the Che Cafe. They served the eviction on March 23rd, and we've been occupying the Che in resistance since then. 93 days and counting.
Oh man, I didn't know that there was an occupation. How has the space changed since then?
Regarding the events we've had since the occupation, we've expanded our programming tremendously. We've had political meetings, for example, hosting the IWW. We've also had workshops, like zine-making workshops, feminist workshops, vegan cooking workshops, and something called FemFest, which is a feminist-centered festival. Speakers from all over have come to speak at the Che. We've hosted workshops with Synchronized Cycle, a feminist bike collective. We've had circle discussions talking about issues affecting the people. We had music events such as Che Fest, which was an all-day music festival. Bands played inside and outside. Upwards of 20 bands played. Hardcore and indie and surf punk. We've also had movie nights ranging from lighthearted movies to serious documentaries, with discussions after documentaries, student film nights, documentaries we made here, queer feminist film nights. As far as music shows, for a while we stopped doing shows because we thought it would help our case with the university. The strategy killed momentum, but it made us less of a threat. When we started doing shows again, the university started threatening us again. We had university security watching us. We've painted the Che, touched up Mario Torero. He painted a lot of the murals. He's a well-known Chicano muralist and did some of the murals on the building. Students have also painted murals. One member of the collective wants to do the mural of a lot of Chicano feminist writers that have a lot of influence on the Chicano identities. The Che has always been a place for marginalized people, including Chicano people. We've done record swaps. There aren't many all-aged record swaps in the area. The Che has always been a place for all of ages to be included. There have also been open mic nights and poetry readings. This has been a recent thing that a lot of people have gotten more and more engaged with. We have prominent poets in San Diego and Los Angeles who will be featuring at the Che on July 24th. There's also something that happens called the Co-op Prom, or Safe Space Prom. The Co-op Prom happens every year for all the members of the co-ops on campus. Co-op members are super connected, and this is yet another form of social bonding for us that can happen in a safe space with lots of political unity. We also have Meatless Mondays. They're nice because they get a lot of students to come to the Che. It's really nice to have students out there. We used to sell vegan donuts and coffee. A lot of people who wouldn't normally come out and ask questions and talk to us about the space. We've even had a play produced here called Sodom and Gomorrah.
Is the Che Cafe on UCSD campus itself?
Yes, it's located in Ravel College. Ravel was the first college in this campus system, and currently there are six colleges in the UCSD system.
I think it's really rad that it's been a place for marginalized folks for so long. I've definitely known folks who've held that space as a really important one for a really long time. Is it okay if I go off script for one question?
Sure.
Without compromising your security or safety, has there been much solidarity with the Che from within the student population, acts of support, etc.?
The majority of occupiers have been students, and there were also graduate students from UCSD that participated as well, also outside help from UCSD alumni. As far as acts of support, there have been minor acts like chalking and banner drops by students in support of the Che, as well as petitions, etc.
Word. How often has UCSD issued eviction notices to the Che? And since the Che is not the only cooperative, does it similarly target other collective spaces on campus?
I don't have the exact number of times that the university has tried to get rid of the space, but in its 49 years, it has been at least 10 to 15 times. We can give you a more accurate number if you like.
No worries on exact figures. I just wanted to get a sense of the extent that the university was trying to evict the space, and it seemed to me that they'd tried fairly often.
Yeah, the master space agreement for all of the other collectives on the campus expired at the end of 2016, which is worrisome.
Really quickly, what is the master space agreement?
The MSA is basically the agreement that, after much effort, allowed for these spaces to have the level of autonomy that they currently hold from the university. And it includes details on rent, etc. To go back to the question of other evictions or threatened evictions, aside from collective spaces, UCSD has in the last decade alone shut down Clicks, a humanities library which was also occupied, Graffiti Hall, Porter's Pub, University Art Gallery, and the Ceramic Center.
That's a crazy amount of resources to shut down. What do you think the universities are trying to do? Is it a question of resources or control over student spaces?
Well, leading to why the university is trying to do it, it might help us to consider that the Che is physically located on the fringe of campus rather than prime real estate. It's on the borders of a much more developed and built-up campus. But along with the other cooperatives, it is one of the few remaining establishments on UCSD that's run entirely by students and community members in the midst of a transformation of the university into a morass of private corporations and centrally run, quote-unquote, student centers. If you look at the corporate donor list for UCSD, it looks like you lined up 100 NASCAR drivers. There's been a lot of construction on UCSD campus, and two of the companies doing that are corporate donors, not to mention that UCSD gets $2.5 billion in funding from the Department of Defense. There's an entire research center dedicated to drones, and a bunch of other surveillance research is done here, and a lot of military research in general.
I had no idea about all of that. That definitely puts the eviction attempts in a totally new light. Thanks for going into that. So, just to clarify, as per the master space agreement, the Che is a relatively autonomous space from UCSD?
Yes, but the attack on the collective and social spaces is not isolated to just UCSD. It's been happening elsewhere. We were talking to someone who went to UC Davis, and the same stuff that has been happening here has also been happening there. It's systematic. And from what we've heard, they've really been trying to shut down the co-ops at UC Davis repeatedly.
What will it mean for the students if the Che gets shut down?
If the Che gets shut down, that means the university will likely increase the pressure on all of the other co-ops because the Che getting shut down would set a precedent. And like we said before, the Che has a long history of being an alternative community and social space for alternative and marginalized students and community members in general. It still very much is this for the community, despite the pressure from the university. If we lose the Che, marginalized students and community members will lose a space that's important to diversity of thought and expression. Keep in mind that the Che is a very long time part of the UCSD campus, even before it was called the Che, back to the 60s and 70s. In addition, without this space, it will be harder for marginalized students and community members to resist against university policies.
For sure. This is such a brutal example of how expression and politics are being increasingly curtailed by institutions.
Yeah, it's all about control, about shifting the university from a public to a private model through any means necessary for the UC system in general.
Agreed. It certainly looks that way to me.
Additionally, an interesting note is that the current head of the UC system, Janet Napolitano, used to be the Secretary of Homeland Security.
That just totally blows me away. Moving on, you've already outlined the political and cultural place that the Che holds on campus, but could you talk about what it means for students to have a safe space within the context of the university?
Oh yeah, we can touch on that question. The Che as it is today is unfortunately unknown to most of the students because the campus is so spread out. The Che, before it was even the Che, used to be the center of student life at UCSD during the 60s and 70s, being in the middle of the Revell College. But there's been purposeful expansion since that has made it harder for students to gather in autonomous spaces. But the Che is still one of the main punk and anarchist spaces in San Diego.
Wait, one of the main anarchist spaces in all of San Diego?
Yeah. In my experience, I haven't seen many other anarchist spaces in this town. The Che seems to be the main nexus for anarchists in the city. Social spaces on campus have really shifted from autonomous student spaces to corporate spaces like the Price Center. Note, This is the largest so-called student center in the country and hosts many capitalist ventures like fast food restaurants and a movie theater. It has over 30,000 visitors a day. We have important safe spaces on campus like the Women's Center, the LGBT Center, the Black Resources Center, and other important spaces, but none of these spaces are as autonomous as the Che. They're politically progressive, where we're more anarchist and are unfortunately more beholden to the university.
Yeah, that makes total sense. It's so important to have spaces for anarchist folk.
Yeah, basically.
Did you get a chance to read the statement from the hobo space in Bologna? If so, do you have any words for those folks?
Yeah, we read the statement, and we definitely stand in solidarity with the students and community members resisting in Bologna. We shouldn't just defend and preserve the existing autonomous spaces, but expand and open more of these sorts of spaces. The stronger the network of autonomous spaces for anarchists and radicals, the easier it will be to resist against power. We encourage the leftist, radical, and anarchist defending existing spaces and open up more of these spaces by any means necessary.
Totally agreed. I know they'll take strength from that. Is there a way for people who aren't in your area to help with the struggle concerning the Che? And also, is there a way for folks to keep apprised of how y'all are doing, a website or something?
Oh, yeah. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Che, that's C-H-E, .cafe.collective. And the Che has a website, which is thechecafe.blogspot.com. And in regards to support, people should get involved more with the struggle for the Che and the co-ops. Join the occupation if you can. Put pressure on the administration whatever ways you can. Donations also help with legal funds, and we have a PayPal account. You can reach us at, this is an email address, checafe@gmail.com. We need more support from the media. If you're in the media, contact us. Spread the word that we're still alive and still fighting. Encourage people to come to meetings. Help us occupy. The more people who resist with us, the better. If you have an event you want to do, you're welcome to do it in the space as long as you put it through the collective process. Send resources like vegan food and books and anything else. Volunteers to help clean up are also really appreciated. Also, pressure the vice chancellor and the chancellor to stop evicting the Che. We have a meeting with the chancellor on July 15th, and the more support we have at that meeting, the better.
Let me know how it goes, and I can report it on the radio if you'd like. Also, are there contact details for the vice chancellor and the chancellor?
Yeah, we will definitely keep you updated. And the webpage with all of that contact info is chancellor, which is spelled C-H-A-N-C-E-L-L-O-R, chancellor.ucsd.edu/cabinet.
That's all the questions I have. Do y'all have anything else you want to close on?
In regards to that, it's important that we fight for these spaces because it's these spaces where we're more free, free of the majority of the power dynamics of our society. And fighting for these spaces ultimately will lead us into fighting against power itself, so we can ultimately abolish authority and power and live a free life where we decide what we want to do, no one else deciding for us, no politicians or bosses, but us living true lives of true joy.
Thanks y'all so much for taking the time to have this interview. Keep us posted and stay safe. We've been speaking with members of the Che Cafe Collective, and you can find them at checafe.blogspot.com about the current occupation on the radical student space on the campus of UCSD. This has been The Final Straw. I'm William Goodenough, and you're listening on Asheville FM, which is at WSFM LP and 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling.
Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. We're speaking with a resident of Olympia, Washington, and going to be sharing with us some perspectives on recent events in the Pacific Northwest, including hopefully May Day of 2015 in Seattle, the shooting of two unarmed African-American youth by law enforcement in the city of Olympia, and the subsequent marches and kicking of the Nazis.
So, should I start talking about maybe May Day?
Yeah,
that'd be great. So 2012 was like the big year for May Day in Seattle, obviously. That was like before the grand jury. And after that, I think the grand jury had a chilling effect, obviously. And there had been kind of smaller May Day demonstrations the previous several years. This past year seems to have been one of the more combative ones in recent history in Seattle. And I think that's in a large part due to kind of the context that had been set by the uprisings in Ferguson and Baltimore. And I think that really set the tone for the day and continued to set the tone in the region insofar as responses to police violence. So that kind of sets the tone for the shooting on the 20th, which was a white cop, Ryan Donald, shot these two young black men, Bryson Chaplin and Andre Thompson, who were accused of attempting to steal beer. And then when confronted by the police, allegedly resisted in some way, although that's contested. And it resulted in them both being shot and hospitalized. One of them in serious condition, the other in critical. And Chaplin is now paralyzed from the waist down. So it's pretty serious.
And it wasn't just one shooting incident, right?
Yeah, from what it seems, there was an initial confrontation and the police officer opened fire. And then these two men allegedly ran into some nearby woods. And then there was another incident where the cop opened fire on them. And so one of them was shot once, and the other one was shot four or five times. Chaplin, who has the more serious injuries, I think was hit four or five times. Their lawyer, the lawyer for the two men, claims that they were shot in the back, like, all of those times, maybe. So they were shot from behind, which implies that they were, like, trying to flee and not actually attacking the cop.
Are there charges against them?
It seems it's unclear to me. Mm-hmm. There's an investigation going on that I think is just investigating the entire incident. And
State authorities or federal authorities?
I'm pretty sure it's
the sheriff's department have to step in.
Yeah, it's local police agencies that the Olympia PD is excluded from that because they were the agency involved in the shooting. But it's, I think, a few local police precincts, the sheriff's department. And so I think there's an ongoing investigation looking into the use of force by the cop as well as the allegations against Andre and Bryson.
So what can you talk about the hours after people found out about the shooting and how the public reacted and how law enforcement reacted?
Yeah, so it happened in like 1:30 a.m. or something like that in the very early morning, but because it was, you know, such a big deal, they cordoned off the intersection, and it was actually very close to the Evergreen State College, and it shut down one of the main roads to get in and out of the college from town. So it was like people kind of knew something was up right away, and so the word spread really quickly to the college and through the college. And Olympia is a really small town. It's something like just over 30,000 people. So the word spread pretty quickly, and I think people were pretty, you know, disgusted. And once again, like, you know, everybody has the frame of mind of, like, the systemic racist violence on behalf of police departments across the country. So it kind of, when people heard about it, it was just like, oh, yeah, great. Like, this has happened here, you know, again. I'm sure it's happened in the past. And so there was, like, a pretty quick reaction, actually, of like, a organized street presence against the police shooting. And the following morning, something like by noon, there was already, like, a protest happening downtown. And there were actually three protests the next day. One of them was, I heard estimates of several hundred people. Which is really big for Olympia. It's probably the biggest street protest that has happened there in several years, mm-hmm. since maybe the port militarization resistance stuff was going on. And the police department's response to that was to actually, their PR department or whatever, like, released this, made this little post on their Twitter or Facebook, some kind of social media, where they said that they appreciated the peaceful protest. And they're just, like, very encouraging of the protest. And it kind of seemed like a way that they were kind of trying to position themselves so that it would look good for them, like they were interested in being accountable. They didn't want people to be angry. There was actually some internal emails between departments that I saw in this...
got leaked.
It wasn't leaked. It was some kind of like Freedom of Information Act request type thing done by the media into the police department, but, you know, not on like a federal level, I don't think. And so these communications were released where the police department was saying that they were worried that something would happen, like there would be a response in Olympia similar to Ferguson or Baltimore or New York, which is kind of laughable, but I think says something very important about the state of crisis that the police are in this country in general right now, to the point where they're concerned that even in Olympia, Washington, like, you're going to have a Ferguson. I think that says something.
It's also interesting to me that the police in Olympia have chosen to, like, I guess for lack of a better phrase, like, co-opt the language of nonviolence as well. And I'd like to point that out too. Like, they said that they appreciate the peaceful protest, and peaceful mm-hmm. protest is such a, like, byword in, like, nonviolence rhetoric.
Yeah, well, they love nonviolence as long as that means that they continue to have a monopoly on violence.
Yeah,
so.
For sure.
So in the so you mentioned the hundreds of people gathering in the streets. Was it what you would call a Black Lives Matter protest at that point, or was it specifically around this case and this individual, or anti-police? And were there any pro-police elements to it?
I was actually working at the time, so I can't speak from any kind of personal experience. But considering how large it was, I would have to assume that it was a very diverse grouping of people. Maybe there were pro-police elements within that. I kind of doubt it. I think that the pro-police elements didn't start emerging until kind of later on as a response to the large protests.
What sort of people were calling for Cop Lives Matter or whatever?
Yeah, well, it's kind of like this tendency that has emerged nationally since Ferguson, where it was like, you know, one manifestation of it was kind of the Blue Lives Matter thing, which was just, like, extremely offensive, like, inherently racist kind of, like, thing put on by pig lovers, where they're saying that, like, police lives matter when police are the ones, like, murdering people in the street. It's like, it's kind of, yeah, it just seems, like, inherently fucked to me. There was a Blue Lives Matter rally at the Capitol during some of the national, like, Black Lives Matter things. And then that was, you know, they don't have very many numbers because the police are not very popular. And so they were like, pretty, I think they were outnumbered by, like, a Black Lives Matter rally that was, like, twice the size of their thing. And it was kind of funny, there's, like, Blue Lives Matter signs, and then somebody was standing next to them with a giant banner that said, "Fuck the police," or
yes.
Something. It just kind of made them look like fools. That even when they tried to organize something, they're, like, way outnumbered, I think, says something about the popularity of the police, at least right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that had already been a tendency to manifest in Olympia before this police shooting that happened. And so it wasn't surprising that kind of emerged again, and it wasn't necessarily the, like, hashtag Blue Lives Matter people, but it was just kind of, like, generally, like, pro-police people who were just trying to push the narrative that, like, all lives matter, which, again, I think is just kind of a way to say that white lives still matter more. And just being like, yeah, the shooting's not about race, let's just, like, not overreact, and let's just, like, get all of the facts. Like, we support the police, they have a really hard job to do.
Was it last year that there was a white men's march or white people's march in Olympia? Or was that a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was within the past year. There was this march, which I guess it was organized by white supremacists on a national basis. It happened in several cities, as far as I know. But I think it was organized underground because nobody knew about it beforehand. And so in Olympia, it was one of the places where there was a like white man march or something, which was horrifying as fuck. You know, Olympia is like very white and has a history of white supremacists organizing in it. And not just Olympia, you know, Olympia probably less so than Eastern Washington and Eastern Oregon, which have like kind of been hotbeds for white supremacist activity for a long time. And there was a response to that where there was a pretty large kind of, like, anti-fascist, anti-racist demonstration that happened. So that happened, and maybe that also helps people be prepared for the emergence of, like, pro-police racists and neo-Nazis that would happen after this shooting.
Can you go into what sort of transition you see between the Blue Lives Matter manifestations and then, like, we're out and proud white supremacists showing up to these events, or when did they start showing up, and how did the police react to it?
Yeah. As far as I can tell, there weren't any neo-Nazis flying, like, their, like, swastika flags or whatever at the like, Blue Lives Matter kind of things. It was just more, like, regular-ass white cop lovers that like to pretend that institutional racism doesn't exist. But there very well could have been Nazis, or at least those sympathetic to Nazis at these events, but it was kind of like, this was like, we didn't really know who the Nazis were until they showed their faces as Nazis, you know, which didn't happen until a little later on. I think the Nazis first made a presence on, the 26th, which was something like 6 days after the shooting happened. And there had been some kind of rowdier nighttime demonstrations that were pretty explicitly anti-police. There had been some conflicts the night before the Nazis arrived that may have like helped them decide to come out, where there was like some small fighting between pro-cop supporters outside of City Hall and kind of anti-police demonstrators. And the police used concussion grenades outside of City Hall, which I feel like is a pretty big deal for Olympia. It's a really tiny place. So that was kind of crazy. It was really spectacular, at least. And yeah, the next day the Nazis showed up.
Did they roll in from out of town, or is that unclear?
It seems like they are regional. Okay. If they're not in town, then they're close to town.
And there's like a few different crews that have. One of the write-ups described specific groupings of, like, maybe not out white supremacists, but, like, citizens, militia folks from different places, as well as different named crew, like the Blacktop Demons and whatever.
Yeah, there were, there's the crew, local crew called Blacktop Demon, which is some kind of car club-seeming gang thing that was out at the, police supporter rallies. I don't know what their deal is.
Like Rockabillies or something?
Something like that. I don't know. I didn't know they existed until all this shit happened, and it was just kind of like, who the fuck are these sketchballs, you know? Mm-hmm. And they're just, like, very, like, posturing, trying to be intimidating, mostly white men, you know? So they're just, like, doing that thing, like, we love the police. And the night that the Nazis came out, the first night the Nazis came out, that Tuesday on the 26th, it became clear that this specific group, the Blacktop Demons, had a relationship with the neo-Nazis because they showed up in what seemed like a very coordinated kind of show of support, were very friendly with the Nazis. And it seemed like they were trying to just, like, physically intimidate the anti-fascists with their presence. And it turns out the leader, or the so-called leader of the Blacktop Demons, is a dude named Joe Tai, who people also found, he's friends with a bunch of the Nazis that were identified as being out over Facebook. A lot of these guys are like kind of like Zig Heiling in their Facebook profile pictures and like clearly Nazis, you know? Yeah, so there's some overlap. It's hard to tell how much.
I just thought of the Chumbawamba song, Patrick Gilmanish.
Yeah.
The Nazi died.
Yeah.
I was thinking, give the fascist man a gunshot.
Yeah.
Gunshot.
I like that one better.
That's a good one.
We've got lots of choices.
There's a Chumbawamba song for every occasion.
Fact. So what sort of people, or what sort of, in what sort of mode were people responding to the Nazis' presence as they started coming out, and like the harder white supremacists as opposed to like soft white supremacists, or as you say in the Northwest, regular ass racists?
Right. So when the neo-Nazis came out, it was like everyone was just kind of in like crisis mode, and there had been, you know, people kind of expected that with so much anti-racist activity and like focus on the institutional racism of the police and anti-racism, that probably some of the sketchiest white people in the area would come out and let their presence be known, because, you know, there's a lot of them, unfortunately. And so there had been some preparation for more openly white supremacist people to come out, I think, based on the appearance of the regular cops supporting seemingly pretty racist people, but more implicitly racist, I guess. And I think, yeah, people prepared for that a little bit. But once it actually happened and once they were on the street, it was just kind of like, you know, there was no announcement that it was going to happen. So it was just kind of like people just trying to react to it. And I think that people felt like the best way to react to the Nazi presence on that Tuesday night when they first came out was to just hold like a, just to have like an anti-fascist presence. And then so on May 30th, there was a call for a large anti-fascist demonstration.
How did the police react to shows of support by open white supremacists?
They have tried to distance themselves from it. Obviously, right now, they're facing a legitimacy crisis, and on a national level, there's just open dialogue about the institutional racism of the police. So, obviously, when there's accusations of a racially motivated incident of excessive force within the police department, they're going to try to distance themselves from neo-Nazis rallying in support of them. And so they released a short statement or some kind of, like, social media thing where they were like, people have been saying that the Nazis were out to support the Olympia Police Department, but this isn't true. I mean, what the fuck else were they doing? I don't know.
Yeah.
There was at least one sign that the Nazis had that said, we support OPD.
So OPD is now speaking on behalf of what the intentions of the Nazis were?
Yeah, so draw what conclusions you will from that.
Yeah,
the OPD does not appreciate the support of the Nazis would be a different way of saying it that would not say that it's speaking on behalf of the intentions of the Nazis.
Yeah.
That's funny.
And so, yeah, they've tried to distance themselves and have just said things that aren't true, like the Nazis were not rallying in support of them when, although there were some neo-Nazis that were expressing like third positionist viewpoints, which is like they're against the state, they're like white nationalist revolutionaries, so they're opposed to the state because they see the state as being this liberal institution which upholds multiculturalism and kind of impedes like the natural racial hierarchy of which white people of course would be at the top. And so there probably were Nazis there that were against the police, but there were also Nazis there that were openly supporting the police. And functionally, they were definitely supporting the police because they were there in response to anti-police protests.
Or they were taking a third position.
Yeah.
In support of ancient aliens.
Yeah.
Ancient
aliens. Or maybe they were supporting the white cop as a white man, but not as a cop. Seems to be maybe the more likely scenario.
Mm-hmm.
The manifestation on the 30th, can you talk about what all you understand happened on that night?
Yeah, so there was just a general call out, kind of like all out into the streets, the Nazis are here. And once again, it's a tiny, tiny town, so the night that the Nazis were out, by the next day, I feel like everybody already knew about it. And there was kind of this precedent set of, you know, through kind of like the radical networks in town of organizing together and coming out into the streets. And so there was actually a really huge, by Olympia standards, amount of people that came out, something like around 200 maybe. I've seen estimates of like 150 to 250. But there was like a lot of people. It seemed to be extremely diverse also, which was pretty inspiring.
Diverse with regard to like what? Diverse with regard to what? Like social scene or economic status or
ethnicity.
Yeah. It didn't seem like it was just all kind of like white radical punks or something, which, you know, if that happened, I wouldn't be surprised. But it was kind of a much broader cross-section of like the Olympia population, you know, as I kind of understand it. The tone was pretty militant and people were pretty angry. And also there, you know, the Northwest has a history with Nazis. Olympia also specifically has a history with Nazis. And there was actually a murder back in the early 90s where two neo-Nazi skinheads beat this young Asian street kid to death in downtown Olympia. And, you know, that was 23 years ago, so it was kind of probably before a significant amount of people who were out that night were even born.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know, you have to assume that still exists in, like, the collective consciousness of that place.
For sure.
And so, yeah, it seems like people were prepared to not let each other get hurt because it was unclear of, you know, maybe there would have been, like, 50 neo-Nazi, like, jackbooted skinheads, like, ready to fight or something. So it's pretty scary, but a lot of people came out despite that.
How were they? Do you care to go into any more details about what that looked like in terms of being prepared to make sure that their friends didn't get hurt?
Yeah, it seems like people were just kind of physically prepared. A lot of, you know, there were a lot of baseball bats were reportedly present. I think a lot of people were wearing masks to kind of conceal their identity from both fascist and police surveillance. Yeah.
How did the crowd generally react in from what you understand to, you know, self-defending black bloc elements within this crowd? Was it like y'all are outside agitators, which is the cry that happens afterwards by mm-hmm. liberals, or was it we're glad that these folks are here, or a mixed bag?
I've gotten the impression since that a lot of people really appreciated kind of the presence of the black bloc, and, you know, people expressed that it made them feel safer. So it seems like, you know, that's kind of an important role being played, which is, in many places, that's often the role that the black bloc plays, is to be the people who are willing to take more risks to keep everyone safe. And whether or not that is felt by the rest of the demonstration, I think, depends a lot on context. But in this particular context, at least from the impression that I've gotten, it seems like people were pretty welcoming, and it actually helped people feel safer.
So what happens when the Nazis showed up?
Yeah, so the march had been going on for a little while, and there was no kind of solid reason to know that the fascists were going to show up, but it was just assumed that they would. And finally, from what I've heard and report backs that I've read, it seems like they were encountered kind of like hiding on this side street, and most of the march passed without even noticing them. Like, they were obviously like keeping a low profile, or so it seems. And there was just kind of immediately a standoff, and pretty immediate fighting started. And I read reports of, and have seen some, a little bit of grainy video of kind of what was going on in it. It seemed pretty intense, and it wasn't too long until the Nazis were literally being chased out of Olympia, like running full speed, being chased down the streets. I heard a report of kind of like a sidewalk cafe type place having their chairs taken and being upset about their chairs being seized.
By the Antifa crowd?
Yeah, by the anti-fascists, their chairs were being taken, and they were kind of like bummed about it. And then afterwards, somebody returned a kind of like mangled up metal chair and was like, sorry about the chair, it was used to do good work against the Nazis or something.
Was the cafe satisfied with that? Or
You know, I would question what kind of person they were if they weren't satisfied by
that.
Yeah, for
sure.
They could hang it up on their wall.
Yeah. And so it was pretty fierce.
This chair kills fascists.
Chair is a pipe bomb. I don't know.
It was really pretty fierce, and as they kind of got in their cars and squealed away from this, like, giant angry mob, their vehicles were attacked as well. And once they were gone, it was just, like, almost like a street party kind of scenario. It was like everyone was just like screaming and hugging and embracing one another and like cheering, and just random bystanders were like, "What happened?" And people would be like, "We just buffed some Nazis up," and then just everybody would be like, "Yay!"
Yeah.
It was kind of just a pretty celebratory environment.
Will you talk a little bit about the statement at the end of the report back that came out of Olympia for this time, for it, like, you know what I'm talking about, the whole, like, we need to remember who our enemies are, and...
I think among some anarchists in Olympia, there's, like, a strong sentiment that folks don't want the kind of, like, institutional racism of police violence. They don't want that to be reduced to just being against Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's pretty easy to be against Nazis. Like, everyone that is not a Nazi is against, you know, are against Nazis. But, like, the reality is, like, no matter how scary the Nazis actually are and how predictable or how unpredictable and violent they are, like, the police are actually, like, the violent force in power. And they're on a daily basis upholding the legacy of white supremacy and the institution of white supremacy. And, yeah, I think one of the report backs I read made a pretty good point to say that although police violence is limited by, you know, kind of the state's need to be legitimate and have these kind of like liberal democratic ideals, that's kind of when the fascists emerge, when the state is in crisis, to basically to enforce the same power structure. And so I think people don't want it to be reduced to just being against kind of this fringe extremist element that is relatively powerless and irrelevant,
mm-hmm.
and also and not also have a kind of more broad and systemic critique of the police as an institution.
For sure.
Do you think it'd be considered limiting to just even talk about the police because the as the main focus? Because the police, although they are the ones that are pulling the triggers and they are the ones that are not getting charges.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the only part of the system. And if we just focus on the police, then we're forgetting the judges and the courts. And I know all that's connected, but the legislatures that pass bills that get cops off the hook or that militarize police forces, the economic binds that de facto redline neighborhoods and populations of color into certain areas or threaten eviction to them and put them in direct danger of constant confrontation with white supremacists or police, you know, by being houseless or whatever. Like,
yeah.
It seems like ending the critique at the point of just talking about the police would be a mistake in the same way, because it's systematic, it's the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, that there needs to be a broader, like, anti-capitalist and anti-authoritarian analysis, and that the police, you know, they're just hired thugs, and they are the most visible manifestation of state violence in our daily lives, but also they're just one representation of it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think it's important to continue kind of pushing analysis and continue like peeling away the layers of white supremacy and every other thing that makes this world horrible.
And like identifying avenues of attack for things like the police, things like Nazis, things like prisons, things like annoying liberals in your community that are like police apologists or whatever, like, I think it's really important to do that as well. And
mm-hmm.
to like identify how people might be most effective or how a target might be like most effectively like attacked or whatever.
I think there's a lot to be considered.
Yeah, for sure. I would urge people to think about that maybe, and to like think about how that makes the most sense for them. And I think that could look a lot of different ways.
Can you talk about it? I don't know. I'm hoping that speaking in terms of, I hope I'm not like contributing to a prophesying thing of the re-rise of the far right. I think it's been going on for a long time, or it's just always present and bubbling to the surface. But being in a community that has at least had this recent event, series of events, and have been trying to figure out ways to not just be insular within subcultures, but try to unite. Like, can you talk about what sort of lessons other communities can take from what's been going on Olympia, and maybe areas for improvement within at least the anti-authoritarian, anti-racist scene within your city? Very question.
Yeah, that's a huge question. Yeah, I don't really have the answer to that. I don't. I wish I did.
Or what are some, besides just not being reactionary and positing yourself as being anti-Nazi or anti-racist only, are there other conversations that you think could be helpful around communities that are struggling against some of these common things?
Yeah, I think there's a ton of conversations that can be had. But I think more important than conversations would be kind of maybe taking more serious the question of what it would look like to actually, I don't know,
succeed.
Yeah. Or something. Yeah.
Success isn't something that we like often talk about or often really experience, maybe. And yeah, perhaps, I mean, like, I was really struck by the image of a thin throng of people being like essentially ecstatic at having had a victory over the Nazi, over like not a Nazi presence.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it makes me think a little bit more of stories that I have heard of like projects that have succeeded and how that looks a lot of different ways and that how that affects people very differently. And like, sometimes success looks absolutely brutal and nobody likes it at all.
Yeah.
And sometimes it looks, you know, like a Stockton Street party after having had a small victory or like a larger victory or something.
Yeah.
So how have the police reacted to the 30th, or how did they react on the 30th?
They were surprisingly not present. And I think that a lot of the time when there are confrontations with fascists in the States, that there are usually a massive army of police protecting them from the anti-fascists. And this is interesting just because it's like, it wasn't, I guess, a national mobilization on the part of the Nazis. It wasn't like publicly organized rally. You know, the police department wasn't preparing for it for months in advance. But also it's within the context of this police shooting. And they really do not want to be seen defending the Nazis, especially right now. And so they were really hands-off, because I feel like it has to be a little bit relieving to them to see people fighting the Nazis and see the focus taken off of the Olympia Police Department. Like, I imagine that's something they're considering a victory. Also, 200 angry people... it's really fucking scary. Mm. And the Olympia Police Department is really small. And it seems like it would have been unnecessary for them to get involved in it. And so they've actually made a statement saying that they are going to approach conflicts and brawls between fascists and anti-fascists in the same way that they handle bar fights, which is basically to not intervene and just observe until the fighting is over, and then go in and kind of determine who the more responsible party is and make arrests and whatever. And I think that's a way to keep police officers safe in like a group violence situation. So it's kind of interesting.
But people shouldn't show up to things drunk at all.
Yeah, probably not.
Probably not.
So we've been speaking with a resident of Olympia about the anti-police and anti-fascist stuff that's been going on there. Thanks a lot for chatting with us.
Yeah, thanks for doing the show.
Hell yeah, brother.
On Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Also on the airwaves of Berkeley Liberation Radio. It can't done. It can't done.
shoot the fascists with a gun, 'cause it's stopping us from unity. We cannot see reality.